looking at, I mean, with the study document for the ELCA Peace Task Force study document that's coming out at the end of September, is going to really strongly assert that, you know, peace is at the heart of the basic biblical story. You know, not to say that there isn't war in the Bible, on that, but in terms of the basic story that's there, it's a story about God's will for peace, and that we know that most centrally through Jesus, but we know it also through creation, you know, through creating order and harmony with diversity. So that's sort of what we did yesterday, and then looked at some of the, you know, different images and how we deal with those, like warrior God and stuff. But today we're going to look more at the theology, you know, at like just war doctrine. Maybe we'll just be three. We've been diminishing. We started out on Monday, I think it's been about 25, and then yesterday we had... Hi, please come in.
Hi.
Oh, if I wasn't teaching this class, I'd be out hiking somewhere.
I think some people are finishing up their coffee.
Coffee, right. Yeah. Well, we're supposed to, for the purposes of the taping, which I assume is going on, one never knows what's really going on, but there's this microphone that hangs down here. And for the purposes of that, I will introduce myself and hi. Say, I'm Carol Jensen, and we are looking at the ELCA Social Statement on Peace, and today especially looking at the theological sources for that. What I want to do is start out with, since only the four of you haven't been this week, right? So that's fine, but we can, you know, talk a bit about what we've been doing. It's sort of a series, but each one has to sort of stand on its own, too. We've been looking at, you know, why is it that we have social statements as a church? And that's really to help the church fulfill its mission in the world. That, you know, we can't just look to the Bible and get the formula for what we need to do about particular issues of our day. That we need to not only look at the Bible, but we need to look at our theological, our confessions, our church history, and we need to look at the social situation, political situation we're in, and put all that together in order to figure out how does the church carry out its mission in the world, the mission for reconciliation, for building peace, for building justice, and so on. So I tried to make a chart. This chart, I'm sure, has a lot of flaws, but what I've been trying to suggest is that there's sort of three fundamental ingredients that go into a social statement. And the first and the most important is what the Bible says. We say in the Lutheran Church that the Bible is normative for us as a church. In other words, it's the most basic measure of what we say and do and teach as a church. But the Bible is also... We look at the Bible through certain eyes, and as Lutherans, we look at the Bible through eyes of our own confessions, and we're going to talk more about that today, and through our church tradition and the creeds, and that helps us sort of get an angle on the Bible. In other words, we look at, Luther said, you know, that the gospel is the norm for the Bible, that the gospel tells us how to read the Bible. So when we read stories like in 1 Samuel about, you know, war and smiting various you know, peoples and so on, we have to look at that in light of God's, you know, peace through Jesus Christ. So really, the theological helps us read the Bible, and the Bible, of course, is the source for our theological understanding. So it's really a back and forth kind of thing. The same with looking at the social and economic and political situation of our day. We read the Bible, the arrow goes both ways again, from the standpoint of that. We're bound in our time. I mean, so we look at the Bible, and we read it through our own situation. So the arrow goes this way, but the Bible also has things to tell us about our own situation. The prophecies, the teachings of Jesus have something to say to us about the situation we're in. So it's, again, a two-way street. And I put a direct line, too, because I think the Bible, because it's the most important thing, also comes directly to us into our social statements. But all these things converge to help us figure out what we have to say as a church and teach about basic social issues, about peace, about human sexuality, about economic justice, about the environment. or whatever. The church right now, how many of you are members of the ELCA right in the...
What's the ELCA?
Yeah, the Lutheran. Are you Lutheran?
Protestant, non-denominational.
Non-denominational, okay. So the ELCA has, right now, a foundational statement that it adopted in 91 that sort of lays the groundwork for all the other social statements. See, the ELCA is a new church. It's only 5 years old, one more 5 years old. So we've had to make a process for writing new statements for the new church because the ALC had its social statements, the LCA had its social statements. And the first ones after the foundational one that we did as a church were one on the death penalty and one on abortion. And the reason why they were chosen first was simply because those topics were chosen first was because the ALC and the LCA were furthest apart in those issues. So that the church, the ELCA, couldn't just use the former statements because they were sort of at a little bit at odds with each other. So they had to say, well, we've got to get, you know, something that's a consensus for the whole church. Then now this summer, the assembly next week, or starting this next week, will be voting on a statement on race, ethnicity, and culture, and a statement on the environment. The peace statement will come up in 95, along with the human sexuality statement, which has been percolating through the church already for several years. The basic process for most social statements is supposed to take, and these are not just a statement on a specific issue, like what should we do about Bosnia, or what should we do about a national health care reform act, but these are more like broader teaching statements, and they take about 3 years to make. And that the reason for that is so that there can be a broad and participatory discussion in the church before the social statements are adopted. And also our church assembly only ever meets every 2 years. So the priority in this whole process is not just on the product and getting the social statement, getting down here, but, and I really should put another thing up here that really goes into this, which is the fancy word, that or term would be moral deliberation in the churches. In other words, that these social statements are not just a product of three seminary professors sitting down and figuring this out and then coming out with this. It's a process of ideas being presented to the whole church and discussed, and the feedback comes back, and there are several stages in that. And like the study document for the Peace Task Force is going to come out the end of September, and then we're hoping a large number of churches are going to discuss it between the end of September and the beginning of January to give feedback to the national church so that, and the task force that's running it, I'm on the task force that's running it for the ELCA, and that will have an impact on what is said, so that it's not just a top-down, but it's a participatory process. And then there'll be a draft social statement that will come out in the late spring, and then that will again be discussed, and then there'll be a final draft statement, and then finally the church assembly will vote on it. Any questions about that before we go into more into this part here? So we're going to focus today. So, any of you been involved in this process in any way? We asked that at the first. Any of you discussed any of the social statements in your churches?
We did the human
sexuality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any of the rest of you? Yeah. Okay, let's look at what is a theological source. I mean, it's, you know, it's a catch-all term is what it really is for looking at sources for us as a church to figure out what we're going to say and do about something that are sort of important but less than the Bible. They're secondary to the Bible. The Bible's most important. And they include the creeds, ecumenical creeds, the Apostles' Creed, which lays out our faith in terms of Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. And then something we're going to talk some about today, the Lutheran Confessions. Every church has a sort of foundational, maybe not every church, that's actually not true. For Lutherans, the confessions are sort of a foundational document, are really important. Some of the Protestant churches have similar kinds of things. Other ones really don't, like Episcopalians don't. But, and then we also have traditions of the church that aren't just traditions of our particular denomination, but are traditions that go back sometimes to the very beginning of the church that aren't in the Bible, but that are part of the sort of whole theological tradition of the church. So we're going to look at some of that today. The Lutheran Confessions, there's something called the Book of Concord. The book I have is a red one. How many of you have ever heard of this? This is something that's real key in seminaries for teaching Lutheran pastors, and a lot of people in congregations have never heard of it. If you come out of Missouri Synod, you probably will know about it if you are a diligent member of Missouri Synod, because it's lifted up more that things have to be according to the Book of Concord. But I think those of us not in the Missouri Synod tradition, probably depends somewhat where you come, but I know the congregation that I serve in as a pastor, there's one man who's former Missouri Synod who knows all about the Book of Concord, or thinks he does, but nobody else in the church council had ever heard of it. When they called me, he wanted to know where I stood on the Book of Concord, and the other people were like, what's the Book of Concord? So, in this Book of Concord, this ancient blue one, I said the modern one is red, but there's something called the Augsburg Confession. And how many of you heard of that?
Okay. I'd like to know something more about the book itself.
Yeah, right. The thing that we it has in it, the Augsburg Confession, which is the most key thing in it. And then it has something called the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, which goes into more explanation of the Augsburg Confession. And it has a small catechism, large catechism. There's something called the Small Called Articles, Formula of Concord, and so on.
Is it written?
They're all from the period from the 16th century.
And the book itself, when was it written?
Yeah, these were gathered. I should know this better. I think the thing was sort of canonized, like the Bible, in the latter half of the 16th century, so after Luther's death. But for example, I don't want to get into this, but ELCA Lutherans say the main thing is the Augsburg Confession. Missouri Synod will say, no, it's the whole nine yards, and that's part of the reason we're not together. We put a higher priority on, because there's some differences when you get into it. But anyway, there's something, there's 28 articles in the Augsburg Confession. The most important one is Article 4, which is, anybody know? It's our basic sort of Lutheran thing, which is justification. It's not just a Lutheran thing, but it's what Lutherans sort of particularly have lifted up as our understanding of the gospel. But there's a lot of other articles too. And one of them is called Article 16, and it has the most to do, which of any of the articles, about the issue of war and peace. Now we may say, why do we have to deal with this if we're dealing? This is written so long ago, why is this important? Some people would argue that it isn't too important, but the Lutheran Church as a whole, even though we recognize that this thing was written 400 some years ago, is time-bound, that it's still foundational, it still holds us together as a church. So we have to sort of deal with it, especially in an official social statement. So let's see if this article has any relevance today. Let me hand out the copies of them.
Does the Book of Concord deal with women in ministry?
No way. No. It deals very little. That's a whole other thing. It deals very little with the ordering of ministry, and that's precise. That's that, of any kind. Which is why we're in this huge study of ministry today in the ELCA. It talks about the office of ministry, and there's these big, probably a lot of big confusions about this, but the office of ministry is the office of ministry for the whole people of God, not for ordained ministers. And there's very little in it, except in the article about bishops, about the ordering of ministry. And that's partly why Lutherans have had a lot of different forms of ordained ministry and non-ordained ministry. So, there's a lot of things that are in this. This was written as a almost sort of a manifesto to Emperor Charles V in 1530. It's pretty early on in the Reformation, laying out, this is our understanding of what Christianity is, Luther and his colleagues. You know, this was before Luther was kicked out, excommunicated. So this is still within the realm of Roman Catholicism. And this is what they're saying, this is how we understand the gospel. And then later Luther says, you know, this is where I stand, I cannot do otherwise, you know. And then, you know, he was excommunicated. But this is still written with the hope that the church will be one. So, you may wonder when you read it how it has a lot to do. It doesn't have a lot directly to do about war or peace, but let's look at it. It's taught among us that all government in the world and all established rules and laws were instituted by God for the sake of good order. Let's pause there. Okay, that's basic Lutheran kind of understanding of that in creation, God gave us government, that we don't have to be opposed to government. And that Christians may, without sin, occupy civil offices or serve as princes and judges, render decisions, pass sentences according to imperial and other existing laws, punish evildoers with the sword, engage in just wars, that's a key phrase, serve as soldiers, buy and sell, take acquired oaths, possess property, be married, etc. Condemned here are the Anabaptists, who teach that none of the things above is Christian. Now see, they're in the middle of this, you know, we're already, and this debate goes on to this day. I mean, you know, our debate with, and who are the Anabaptists today? They're the Mennonite, the Brethren, you know, Quakers a little less, but Mennonite and Brethren especially, who are historic peace churches, who held, early on in the Reformation, you know, the Reformation started rolling, and this thing spread like wildfire, you know. And people just were like going nuts, you know, basically. And some in some positive ways, and some maybe Luther thought they were getting too far out. And the Anabaptists were people who were rejecting civil authority, rejecting the rule of law. And Luther did some pretty reactionary things at a couple points in terms of sort of coming down against people who were protesting against the kings and the nobles and stuff.
But it's an interesting sidelight here that the Anabaptists were people who just drove J.S. Bach crazy.
Who drove who?
J.S. Bach.
Uh-huh.
Crazy.
Right. Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah.
Because they opposed the general direction of the music he was writing.
Interesting.
And the life he was living and the strength with which he spoke his views.
Interesting. See, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Bach, of course, was Lutheran. And, I mean, out of that, you know, at that same time. But, so they probably thought it was too sort of imperial or too worldly, right? I mean, they saw the church as more of an alternative, and that it had to be more against established authority rather than sort of working within it. And to this day, we have, you know, people in the Lutheran Church that take a slightly more Anabaptist position. You know, that's a debate within our church today. People. You know, people like, some of the people associated with Holden, Larry Rasmussen, Dan Erlander, would be people that are, you know, leaning more toward that Anabaptist kind of perspective than like a Bill Lazarus or, you know, some of the traditional ethicists of the Lutheran Church. Okay, so they condemn, you know, partly they're trying to set out where they are. They're making this appeal to the emperor and saying, we're not like these, you know, people. So these people are condemned. Also condemned are those who teach that Christian perfection requires forsaking of house and home, wife and child, renunciation of such activities as are mentioned above. Actually, true perfection consists alone a proper fear of God and real faith in God, for the gospel does not teach an outward and temporal, but an inward and eternal mode of existence and righteousness of the heart. The gospel does not overthrow civil authority, the state, and marriage, but requires that all these be kept as true orders of God, and that everyone, each according to his own calling, manifest Christian love and genuine good works in his station of life. Okay, there's another key point coming up. Accordingly, Christians are obliged to be subject to civil authority and obey its commands and laws in all that can be done without sin. But when commands of a civil authority cannot be obeyed without sin, we must obey God rather than people. Some people leave out this last sentence, and it's interesting. Of course, this would be a confessional argument that a person arguing to be a, our church supports selective conscientious objection, even though the government in this country does not acknowledge, you can't say I'm against this war and get CO, you have to just say I'm against all wars. But our church's position is that, and it has to be in a way, because of the sentence, that you can have selective conscientious objection, which means you can, there may be some wars that we think are sinful, and therefore people have to be able to obey God rather than the government. So that's really the plank or leg you'd stand on if you wanted to argue as for a selective CO position of Lutheran Church.
There's a statement in here that I don't even agree with.
Well,
one that you read, I wouldn't agree with.
Yeah, which one?
That the gospel doesn't teach an external and an outward, temporal and outward.
Yes.
But inward.
Right.
Eternal. I think it teaches both.
Exactly. Of course. And that, you know, I mean, this is the thing. You know, people say, well, we have to look at these critically because, you know, and I think, you know, yeah. I mean, you see, he's you know, we just like we read the gospel, you know, we read the material in the Bible, we have to read this with an eye to who's he arguing with? what he's trying to build a case so that they're going to get kicked out of the church. And he's trying to, like, and actually this was written not by Luther, but by his colleague Melanchthon, who was, you know, sort of more into this legal language and stuff. So that's, so that the basic assumption, I think, underlying this article, and this goes back to when yesterday we were talking about sort of the biblical story, is that how Lutherans read the biblical story is that human beings are created for peace. At least this is what we're going to argue in our statement. But we are bound in strife and sin. So we really have an understanding of sin. You know, that's one of our things. And because of that, laws are necessary. Use of force, and the understanding that goes into this is that because of that, because of sin, laws are necessary. We have to have governments that restrain evil activity, and that sometimes force may be necessary. So this is sort of the kernel to Lutheran approach to war and peace out of our confessions. Not so much out of the biblical, which we did yesterday, which I think would give you a little different angle. I think if you look, we talked yesterday a bit. If you just look at the New Testament, you have a pretty strong basis for pacifism. You have a pretty strong, and we'll come back to that hopefully, and we'll have enough time to talk about that. But that we understand that sin in human beings is so deep that that we have to deal with the sinfulness, and that part of that is law and enforcement of law. Any comments at this point before I go on here?
I have another question.
Yeah.
Another group flourishing at about the same time as the Anabaptists were called Pietists.
Mm-hmm.
What is the relationship between those two?
Actually, Pietism was a little different. Anabaptism started earlier. Really, very soon after the beginnings of the Reformation with Luther's 95 Theses and all these things. And like I said, for the times when there was no modern communication, I was amazed at how fast this stuff spread. I mean, to England and to, you know, there were Lutherans in England before, you know, back in like the 1520s and stuff before. I mean, Lutherans in the